outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Hey, well, I'm off running around in Nashville, joining some people down there this weekend. Kyle and I are finishing up the podcast we started last week. Hi, I'm Wayne Jacobson. This is the God Journey. Kyle's not here, but we made up for it last week. So here's the continuation of our discussion about navigating uncertainty, the state of religion and young people. It's from the Springtide Research Institute. Links to it are in the podcast notes below. Anyway, if you want to help people navigate uncertainty, what's it going to take from you? I think the greatest indicator in our heart of if our journey is working, it was that we're finding fullness of joy dire situations, that we're finding peace when I'm at risk. It's not I'm at peace because everything in my life is great. It's because God's bigger than the stuff going on in my life. And I think those were indicators. When you get to the Upper Room Discourse, Jesus is giving us indicators. My joy in you, you're joyful. Life and life abundantly. Ask whatever you want in my name. It will be given to you. He's saying some pretty definitive realities that most Christians are like, it doesn't work. I tried it, man. I asked God to heal my wife dying of cancer. He didn't do it. So then they discount the words of Jesus rather than going back and saying, maybe our process is flawed.
Yeah.
If what I'm doing doesn't lead me to that, then what I'm doing needs to be reexamined.
Yes.
And maybe I find something freer to walk in. That's why, to me, when he gets to the place of when you feel overwhelmed and don't know what to do, this is back to the book that Josh Packer did about navigating uncertainty. He says, who do you turn to for help? 55% say friends, 49% say family, 20% say someone from school. And I know these are more than 100 because you're allowed more than one answer. But only 16% included someone from their faith community as an answer, not even the number one answer. When they talk about where'd you feel safe during the pandemic, 29% said school, 22% said work, 22% said shopping, 20% said in public. Only 18% said in church somewhere, or another 11% in spiritual gathering. So you've got, no wonder this is not the answer for them. It's not a place to go. It's not where I'm going to discover truth. It's not where people are going to help me. It's where I'm going to get manipulated. Mm-hmm. I don't feel safe there. And then on the next page of this, and I love this list he does of what it is that people, if you want to get this from the retreat we had, people saying, Wayne, I want to be one of those people. I want to help young people. How do I do it? And, you know, it's like, where can I go or what can I do or what program do I have? He lists 8 here, and I don't necessarily agree with all of them, but I do love the place it puts us in. The first one he says is create safety. Now, is that the first thing you think about going to a religious counselor for help, that they're going to be a safe place to go?
It depends, honestly. I know some people who have been like, so for example, my therapist, and again, I strongly advocate, don't ever trust a therapist that doesn't have their own therapist. Because
I've never had a therapist. I should probably pick one up.
For me, like, it was one of those things of, unless I was willing to do the work and experience what it was like to be in my client's space, if I wasn't willing to really pursue that heart change and figure out what does this look like, then how could I sit on the other side of the room and ask them to do what I wasn't willing to do? That just felt inauthentic to me. And so my counselor that I work with when I'm navigating some hard things and I'm feeling stuck and need just a different perspective, they're a faith-based counselor. They're a faith-based, but they are a professionally licensed doctorate in clinical psychology background. But, and this is the sad part, Wayne, I would be more afraid to go to a pastoral counselor, like somebody who is like quote unquote working at a church that's providing the counseling services. My guards would be instantaneously more up in that space than they would be in a secular clinical counseling space.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is a problem. That's what I meant by a religious counselor.
Yeah.
You know, someone at an institution. Some of the counseling I did in times past, you've got all the answers. So somebody's coming in there struggling. You can tell them, do A, B, and C, get out of here, do better, try harder.
And here are your proof text. Here's the proof text in order to prove what I'm saying is right.
This proves why you're screwing it up. Yeah. So creating safety. So people, you want to help people create a safe environment for people to explore around you. Don't go panic. Don't go forcing answers. Some of the stuff we've talked about earlier in this podcast, even, or at this point, last week's podcast, since this is probably going to end up being a couple of them. Yeah. I think that's really important. How do we create safety for people who are near us?
What are some of the themes that you look for in safety? Like, how do you recognize that a person is safe?
I don't know that I have a list of attributes. I know when I'm with somebody and I feel it's safe to question and explore here.
Okay.
And I know when I'm with other people where it's not. The expectation is conformity. Mm-hmm. That's where my family has gone, my extended family. Conformity is king. So if you don't toe the line, we will kill you.
Yeah.
There's only one answer allowed, and that's the answer we want. And so I think intuitively, we all know this person's safe. This person's not safe. And so I don't know. Do you have a set of attributes you look for?
There are a few things that are, again, like that comment of the Karens or the trail markers of like, ooh, okay. the C-A-I-R-N-S's.
I know what you meant. I knew you meant the other kind of Karen.
But like, for example, somebody who is willing to admit their mistakes and are sharing with me some of the flaws or some of the ways that they're still wrestling with life, it's like, oh, okay, you don't have it all together and you don't have all the answers. You're still learning. Somebody who in whatever way expresses that they're still learning and that they're still asking questions, that to me is a cue that, okay, I can explore here with that person. That's one. And I would agree with you. There's just a sense like there are people that I've met where right out of the gate, I'm like, ooh, yes, I can trust this person. I feel at peace with just the presence of who this person is. And there are others where there's just that gut check of, I feel like there's an agenda here. For whatever reason, it doesn't feel like this is a safe space. Whether there's like a hint of, I feel like there's an underlying agenda, or there might be some manipulation here, or this person's just waiting for me to stop talking so that they can give their answer. Like I can just see them like in anticipation of they've got so much they want to say and they're just waiting for me to stop talking. Like, oh, okay, well, I should probably stop talking and let them do whatever they want to do, but I'm not going to share a whole lot more of what's going on in my heart.
Especially when their answer doesn't fit what you just talked about.
Oh, I know. Then it was like 10 minutes ago.
They stopped listening to you 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So, figure out, ask Jesus, what makes you a safe place for people to talk out stuff with? That's really important. Second one was grieve what's been lost. Talk about that one a little bit. What does that mean to you?
I was just having a conversation with Jess about this, and we're walking with a couple that was navigating some marital challenges. And one of the biggest things was grieving the expectations. So whatever it might be, like working with students that, for example, they going into the 2020, spring 2020, the 2020 graduates, they had all these expectations of what their senior year was going to look like, what graduation was going to look like, what their senior trip was going to look like, what their first year of college was going to look like. They had all these things built up in their heart. And then all of a sudden, in a blink of an eye, for nothing that they could control, that all got taken away from them. Yeah. And that can look a lot like, I mean, that can look very different for people in different circumstances and things that they're going through. But I think giving yourself space to genuinely grieve that there was loss that occurred, right? That with uncertainty, that's part of it, is that often what happens is in the midst of that quote unquote certainty, we lost the certainty of something. You know, whether it be the certainty of my graduation or the certainty of my job or the certainty of my family, all of a sudden something got lost. Something was taken away or something was disconnected. And there's a heart loss there that really needs to be given appropriate space to be able to navigate.
Yeah. And if we can't grieve what we lose, we'll either just stay mired in the anger, the feeling like we've been victimized, and that's never going to lead people on in a healthy way. I do think at the time you have to realize, there's something I wanted or something I may have had and somebody took it away from me. It was like the lovely team we had celebrating the Shaq book in the world and all that was going, and then that got taken away. And I could still be pretty bitter about it, you know, 20 years later or whatever it is. Instead, yeah. I've just gone, okay, I can't control that. I've got to lay it down. I'm going to grieve it. And I mm-hmm. have grieved it. I've grieved things this year that I've lost.
Yeah.
Grieving, I think, is such an important way to lay down. Even if, like we talked about last week, some of that grieving is my idealization yes. of what I thought my marriage would be, what I thought my life would be, what I thought my job would be. I there's so much that we've idealized, which is very close to the word idolized, idol. Those are idols in our lives. And we're seeking to reach an idealized existence. Rather than staying inside the reality of today with the breath of Jesus in my life, I think we get really mired in dark places. I think that's where a lot of those people talk about wilderness experiences are. They're just disillusioned and angry that something got taken away from them. And it may have been their innocence as a child. Someone molested them, abused them in some way. And you can grieve that or be angry your entire life. There is a place to grieving, and the grieving lets go, and it opens up to the possibilities I have now instead of what I may have lost back there. And I think that's – so if you've got that in your own life, if you don't grieve what's already happened to you or what you feel like, your victimhood's going to get passed on to somebody else. It'll come out in angry, manipulative ways. So if we're talking about how am I going to help if I want to help other people follow Jesus. I think that's how we're going to use this little section of the book. I just love that. Grieve what you've lost and grieve with them when they've lost stuff. Don't so quickly go, oh, well, Jesus knows better. And, you know, they're in a better place when they've lost a spouse or a child and all the crap we put on people because we're not willing to sit in grief with people. Good grief is a very healing reality. And we want to get just people into, oh, pretend you're joy and God's in control and everything's good and happy. You're not a safe place, man. People are going to run from that, as they well should.
And that's part of the problem, right? Like what we were talking about in last week's podcast about, you know, that certainty and about having the answers. Because if we have to grieve, then at least in some of the underlying conversations that I've had with people, if we have to grieve, then that means that God isn't good. Right. That all of a sudden, like I'm a Christian. I shouldn't have to grieve. I shouldn't be experiencing pain. I shouldn't be going through these hard things. I shouldn't have loss.
The victorious overcomer in everything. Right.
Exactly. Yes. And yet that's not attributing. I mean, there's nothing in Jesus's life. There was things that Jesus grieved. There was some deep heartache that he gave genuine space to say, man, I've got to hold space for this for a period of time because there is deep pain that's to be here.
We've learned to do that with the dogs that have died. And we love just dogs. We love them. They become part of our family. When one of them originally died, the earlier ones, it's like, oh my gosh, pain. And why can't they live forever and struggle and all that? Now we just have a weeks of where we just talk about that dog and cry and miss them and get a new puppy right away. But we really do have a space to just crawl in our tears with God, let that grief, and then I think what grief, lovely thing grief does is it changes memories from painful to joyful. Mm. Now we can talk about all those dogs with great joy. That's what this dog added to this family, or this is how that dog was unique. This is how this dog made us laugh.
Yeah.
All those memories become joyful because you've grieved. And people who skip grieving, people who want to put on a brave face and, oh, I just trust Jesus, everything's great. I think you miss the healing that comes in an honest kind of grieving. I do. Next one is celebrate what's been gained.
What are your thoughts on that?
That's interesting. I'm not thrilled about all these. I think, number one, if it's talking about me helping someone else, then when something good's happened in their life, the tendency is to see how far they've fallen short still and start correcting things instead of really celebrating where celebrating is due. When I see this journey as much more of a process than a product God's after, it allows me to celebrate the journey. It allows me to celebrate gains in the journey without going, yeah, but this and yeah, but that, and that's not there. So that's how I see it being valuable. Overall, for my own life, I mean, I enjoy things that come together in a beautiful way, and I celebrate healing with God. I celebrate relationships that got off track, getting back on track. There's lots to celebrate in this journey, and I think that's valuable. I think I kind of do that without having to try. I just, when something good happens, I'm just grateful and excited. But then it says to do that without insisting on optimism.
Yes.
So without just trying to fake fakely buck somebody up to a better days are ahead kind of garbage.
And I think you actually just, I think subconsciously just hit the nail on the head with the word grateful. Like I love the idea of celebration. And I think that's one of the things that the Jewish culture does really well is they have specific holidays that are really celebrating different aspects of the life to be found in God. And I don't think we do that well. At least in my experience and in my life, I'm still learning how to celebrate that better. But I think that posture of having a grateful heart, that even in those challenging situations of saying, Lord, this isn't comfortable, this isn't fun, and yet I thank you for the, like, literally the grace that has been just barely enough to get me through the day, barely met the quota, but it was there. And not in a fake optimistic way or not in an untruthful way, but just, man, those times where at least there was a drop of water when I was absolutely dying of thirst. Like there was one just enough to where I was able to keep going.
And I think a good indication of the problem we're having with the former, the idealized thing.
Yeah.
If you're not living a grateful life, it's because you have expectations of God that he's never going to meet the way you want them. So you never, that was me for a lot of my journey. I gratefulness was a discipline.
Yes.
Now it's not. I'm with you. Any good thing God drops in my heart, this little phrase about you've not passed this way before, knocking on my heart twice in 2 days and go, that doesn't answer all the problems going on in my life right now, but it causes me to just pause and go, that's awesome, God, that you'd arrange that just so I could have a little wink from you about it.
Yeah.
Next one's resist comparison.
This one, honestly, Wayne, I come back to what Brene Brown said about comparison, that comparison is the thief of all joy or of genuine joy. I don't think there is a better way to summarize the result of comparison in a person's life than that. And the hard part is that our world is saturated with comparison, especially by our digital leashes that go with us everywhere. There is no better way to convey or to have an outlet for comparison than that digital leash that goes with us everywhere. I mean, it's instantaneous. It's right there. If I'm having a good day, it can be gone. It can be deflated in 30 seconds. If I go on Facebook or on Instagram or whatever, and all of a sudden see something, I'm like, ooh, but I'm not in Tahiti doing this with my spouse, you know, like whatever it might be, you know, it can be that genuine thief of joy so quickly.
Yeah. There's no way to, you know, build the idealization of our own life than looking at other people's lives that are in a setting where only the idealized stuff gets on there. Look how, unless somebody dies, that gets on there. But for the most part, you know, they're not telling you about the problem, the fight they had with their spouse the day before, the problem at work or the accusation someone, you know, that stuff doesn't go on there. So you're seeing an idealized version of a life, and that creates an ideal for you that leaves you, like you say, just could suck your joy right out of life. I agree with that. How I saw this one, and this is going back to not just for me, because I've, comparison is just never a way to live, never been in my life. Well, I wouldn't say, I'd say in the last 28 years. I look at it in meetings I'm often in where people kind of share something really vulnerable from their life. And then someone else will say, hey, I was going through this. This is what God did. This is what God showed me. And it's comparison, not just we're comparing who's better off, but it's saying God always works in the same way. Mm-hmm. And I watch the person shut down when this happens. I saw it recently in one of the trips I made. Somebody said, well, I was in a thing. This is what I did. And I looked at him, I said, so what you're saying is that's a thing that if everybody does that, they'll get the same result. He goes, yeah, ooh, of course. I'm going, really? He said, well, you don't. I said, you're taking what God did in you and it bore fruit. Are you saying that this person should do the same thing? And he actually later thanked me for rebuking him, which I wasn't trying to be obvious about. And I wasn't trying to rebuke him so much as I was trying to get the room to see. Because this is what I have to say to people. When somebody really gets vulnerable, boy, the counselors come out in the room, people who want to fix that. And they're always going to fix it with what God showed them, with not a critical eye toward, is this the same situation? Is that the same person? Might God be saying something different to that person? That when I read that, I'm going, man, there's no way to be more unsafe. And I think this is why so many prayer meetings falter and Bible study groups, let a need be known. and you'll be leapt on by every would-be counselor on the planet who's got an answer for you that doesn't even work for them. Because that's how religious answers work. And I have to tell people, look, don't talk to that person. They've just shared something with me. They want my input to that. So it's not that you may not have wisdom, but why don't, if you have something to share, don't share it with them that puts them on the spot. Share it with me. Hey, Wayne, I went through something similar. Now I've got a way to help process that. Otherwise, man, and I know there's so many people starving to be fixers in religious settings that I fear when somebody really gets vulnerable, if the wrong person's in the room, they'll shut down that vulnerability so quickly by throwing out a pat answer or something that's not even related to what they're going through because it worked for you. But, and you just can't wait to share it because, and they're sharing it is more about validating their experience, which is still somewhat empty, than it is really helping the person they're trying to help. And so
that's good.
If you want to be a helper, don't just throw your stuff in there like it's going to make the same sense to them it made to you. Okay, get together to combat isolation with intentional gatherings. It started out well. It ends so poorly.
It like went from great to instant yuck meter pig.
Get together intentionally. Do it. Sarah and I have so learned to walk this way. Before, we used to have meetings and invite people to meetings. And if you didn't come to meetings, it's because you want to be alone and you're going to get what you deserve because you're not making my meeting successful by coming here. So lump it. Now it's like Sarah and I are sitting there going, who might need us this week? Who could we get with that's a little bit isolated, a little alone, maybe struggling? How can we find a way to be with them?
Yeah.
Not how can we plan a gathering and invite them to it and hope they come and be blessed and inspired? No, it's like, how do we be? I look at Jesus going to Zacchaeus, I'm going to your house tonight, going, when does that ever happen? We always create meetings and invite people, and the serious ones come, but then not much real happens there. I love just being able to be the initiator of opportunities to get there. I think with my travel now, I've mostly responded to invitations. I've had so many invitations, I can't manage them all anyway. And now there's places on my heart to go where I don't have an invitation.
Ooh, okay.
But I'm just going to say, you know what? I'm going to go there. I'm going to see what God does. And so some of my travel, it's not that I still don't have invitations. I do. But when I really say, gosh, this is on my heart, and I'm expecting an invitation to come because that's how it's worked in the past.
Yeah.
And now it's, well, maybe you just go.
I love that.
I don't know that I do love it because I could just go somewhere and just, you know, sit in a hotel for 3 days and come back home again. But who knows? But it's interesting. Jesus obviously took the risk to say to Zacchaeus or sit with a woman at a well, or he was not just responding to what everyone else wanted him to do. He looked for opportunities. He looked for ways to engage. And with Zacchaeus, he's not choosing the most exciting guy in town. He's choosing the crook.
Yeah. And there was the part of it was just proximity, right? I mean, he was at the well at a given time where he honestly wasn't even expecting to encounter the woman at the well because she wasn't supposed to be there at that time. But she was avoiding everybody else. And so she showed up at an awkward time of the day and Jesus happened to be there.
Yeah, we got neighbors like that. Sarah and I like getting to know our neighbors and we'll go, hey, why don't we go out to dinner sometime? And they'll go, oh yeah, we would love that. And so then we'll invite them and then they're busy. I say, why don't you let us know when you want to go? And then we never hear from them again. It's kind of a self-pruning technique. There's probably not a lot of fruitful. They're not wanting to be together with somebody they don't know. And it could be a lot of reasons for that. Yeah. But I don't have to force myself on people. I just get to be intentional about inviting people into my life. Mm-hmm. And those that come, then I get to explore some neat stuff with them.
The idea of getting together, I love what you just shared. And I think it's very important because it's part of that reclaiming of something, right? Where for so many, the idea of let's get together, it's like, well, let's do a book study, let's do a Bible study, instead of, I just want to be around you. We can do games, we can do a meal, like whatever that looks like, but I just want to be around you. And I think that's, man, to be able to just be with somebody without an agenda or without something that you're pressuring, but just to say, I would just want to enjoy time with you. Honestly, that's something that hasn't been modeled well to young people as far as just spending time for just the sake of enjoying doing that, because so much of it now, so much of their relating takes place on their phone or via social media, etc. And especially when the pandemic hit, I think it really highlighted that need or that desire to be with people in person. But then it also highlighted, like, ooh, I don't know if we do this super well. Like, I don't know if this is, like, I'm not exactly sure how to do this. This feels uncomfortable in some regards.
Yeah, we talk about getting the system out of us or getting us out of the system. You know, it's easy to get out of it. It's easy to get out of us. I think one of those things religious people really struggle with is everything has to have a purpose, has to have an agenda, and the purpose isn't relationship.
Yeah.
It's, I want to help you, or I want to move you forward, or I want to, it's not just, no, the nature of being together. And with some people Sarah and I have been with, we may spend months or years connecting in various ways with them before we're inside the space where they're really to open up some stuff to us or a crisis comes. But it's the relationship you've built all the other time for no other reason. That's the only reason you need to spend time with people. It's just the relationship on their terms, not on my terms. I don't invite them over to do this X, Y, or Z. Invite them over. Get to know them. What do they enjoy doing? We'll do that and explore your way into what's happening. The next two of these are kind of goofy, so I'll skip them. But I thought the last one was...
Actually, can I circle back really quick to the two that are kind of a little weird? Is that okay if I circle back to them?
Why?
Because I think there is some importance with it, if you don't mind. So the two that...
And I mean, if I don't mind, you're part of this conversation.
I know, but like... So the two things that are like that come up are take care of your body and turn to the arts. And initially, like when I was looking at that, I was like, yeah, okay. But I think that there's something to do, especially circling back to celebrating and play. I think there's something to do with not necessarily when I hear the arts, I think creativity. I think the act of creating, the act of doing something, being a part of that creative process. And especially with young people, that's not the invitation. Everything's already set up for them. There's not like there's this prescribed, like whether it's a game or it's an app or it's a social media system, you know, for the most part, here's the parameters. This is how you're supposed to do it. There isn't that joy of being a part of the creative imaginary process. And I feel like that can be really restorative, really healing to people, and can really – those are those times when I'm out doing something or I'm out creating or I'm being creative. That really helps me personally realign and reconnect with some of the things that God has created me to be. And I think that they're kind of interesting. They're weird points, but especially coming from a counselor's perspective – one of the primary things for dealing with depression and anxiety is physical exertion. And especially in our world where 90% of the time we're sitting in an office, we're sitting on a couch, we're sitting in a classroom, we're sitting in a car, like there isn't that movement. There isn't that release of the, which is crazy, but the naturally God designed chemicals in our body that actually help us feel better and experience more wholehearted life. God actually created chemical systems in our body to help us fight against anxiety and depression. But because of a lot of the sedentary lifestyles that we live, we don't utilize some God integrated things in our life. Like for example, you have a God integrate, you do a physical activity every day, don't you, Wayne?
I do multiple.
Right.
I work out every day and I go for a 4-mile walk every day.
And so those would be things like I'd say, I would redirect take care of your body to that space of how many times do you go on a walk, whether it be with another person or just by yourself, where there's such a rich encounter with the Holy Spirit. What do you think? Is that something that happens regularly for you? Or is it more just, I just want to go on a walk as part of your rhythm?
I don't know. I find that Jesus shows up not so much on a walk. I enjoy the walk. It clears my head, clears my heart, but I don't find often that there's some, the revelations seem to come in other venues in my heart. It used to always be on a walk, but it hasn't been for a long time.
Interesting.
Okay. How I read these is like, okay, let's sit down and talk about, okay, now we gotta take care of your body. I agree that physical activity is really important to the human experience. I do, but I wouldn't sit down with somebody and say, you know what? You're too sedentary. You ought to do something more. People just get turned off that. But I would say to someone, come up and say, I'm going on a walk tomorrow. Would you like to go with me?
Yeah.
And now see what that brings up. I mean, I do think the physical exertion, or let's go play tennis, let's go play golf, let's do something. I do see the value in that for sure. And the other was turn to the arts to find new modes of expression. I have been in so many corny settings where the crowd breaker, some kind of draw picture of your devotional time. I say it's fabricated garbage. But in terms of helping people discover creativity, whether it's, you know, gardens or artwork or songwriting or writing. I think there's value in that. I see it as not so much in terms of helping the people in this podcast that we're trying to say, how are you going to be available to young people? It's not necessarily do art, but I tell you what, you want to spend time with people and you like art. Sarah and I were on vacation, a few months back, and there were painters out painting the landscape who are on a coastal area. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody stops and talks to a painter. It's incredible. You could probably have 100 conversations a day if you're good at what you're painting. And people, ooh, I like that, blah, blah, blah. Now you're into a conversation, right? So I can see the value in that.
And that goes back to avoiding the contrived or the manipulated or the facade, right? It's what is it that you're passionate about? And how, like, what are those things that God's given you that you have a love for that all of a sudden you're inviting other people into, or he's using that as a catalyst to create those relationships or those connections or those conversations that you never thought you would get into.
The last one, focusing on the practical, I wanted to get to there was just the people I know who really touched young people well are not just in and around their life to give them spiritual direction and purpose. Often those relationships start because I help somebody learn how to change oil on their car that they just bought. I teach somebody how to care about this or how to deal with that. It really is. It may just be someone needs companionship and a meal, and it's inviting them over and cooking for them. And it's one person we had that never learned to cook. Their family went out to dinner all the time. And Sarah and I had them over for about 10 meals over a few months' time and just say, you tell us what you want and you come over with us and learn to cook. Those kinds of things open tremendous doors. Look for practical ways to help people gain a skill. Particularly, you talk about the lack of adulting skills in a lot of young people today. Gosh. And if you've got some adulting skills and you've got some kids that want to learn how to balance a budget, how to fill out their taxes, if you're a helper in the world, you'll have connections and opportunity.
Yeah.
And if it's just about passing on your spiritual wisdom, and again, that's the idealization of someone like me or a pastor type or whatever, I just want to make my living on the gospel and I just want, you're not going to find the connections that are really life-giving. Even being at retreats, I was a little disappointed when our retreat found out they were going to cook for us, because I really like being in the kitchen with people on a retreat cleaning. I mean, it was great they did it. It was great food, a lot of more time for other things. But there's something to be said of being practically involved. One of the camps I went to in Australia, they invited me. They went to this camp and they were going to do all the meals and everything. So what they agreed to do is they're going to spend an hour a day doing something to bless the camp. And so the camp had a project. And one day we were out there picking up sticks, just things that had fallen down in the wintertime. There were sticks on the ground. They needed to be piled up so they could burn them. So we were out collecting sticks and talking. And one guy started complaining, what am I doing? I paid for this retreat. And the guy who was leading just walked over and said, sir, this is a gift to the camp that we want to do. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. Go back to your room, go read, go do whatever, or sit on the, do whatever you want to do. This is our way of helping. And he goes, oh, I didn't know that. So he goes right on helping. I thought it was interesting. Anything else from this book, Kyle, that you want to make note of? We've done two podcasts on it now, so we'll break this into two rather than kill somebody with an 80-minute podcast. But
I mean, there's lots of things, but I guess I would want to just, I love, and we could finish it up with this quote that Todd Packard had. And he said, one thing is abundantly clear. The youngest generation, Gen Z, is pressing forward, exploring the boundaries of their faith, constructing meaning, navigating uncertainty, and encountering the divine in new ways. The only question that remains is whether you will be there to guide them. I don't like that last sentence.
I don't like the last word. Well, you'll be there to help them or serve them.
Yes.
To guide them. Let the Holy Spirit do that, man. That's his job.
But I love, I would say, and I wouldn't just attribute it to Gen Z. I would say that both you and I are encountering that as of right now, humanity is pressing forward. They're exploring the boundaries of their faith. They're constructing meaning. They're navigating uncertainty and they're encountering the divine in new ways. And I love that. I absolutely love that.
And if we're not so threatened that that's outside of our religious institutions or the ways we've done it, that we could celebrate this as probably the time when God's most able to reveal himself to a new generation of people.
Yeah.
Because they're not finding comfort in the old answers. And the old answers sucked anyway. The discussion I liked at the very end of this was the thing about bundling and unbundling. Mm. And I hear about construction and deconstruction all the time. I think this is a better word. Unbundling just is finding what your religious experience or life, unbundle it from everything belongs together. So what worked for me there? Like this is like not throwing out the baby with the bathwater kind of thing. Unbundle your religious experience. What worked for you, keep it. What didn't work, toss it. And then rebundling, I think of this politically. I hate how the Republicans and Democrats have separated us along a certain set of issues.
Oh my gosh!
If you care about race, you're going to be a Democrat. If you care about abortions and anti-immigration, you're going to be Republican. If you know they bundled these things all together, that I reject. I don't have to believe that because I also love that. So this is better than deconstructing, throw everything out and start over, but unbundle. Just take what's good and continue with it and then bring some other things that are good and build something that's meaningful in your life that God can be at work in rather than go through this whole deconstruction, which to me is always about principles and doctrines and theologies. That's what deconstruction is. Rather than, no, this is about life. So what works for you, what enhances your relationship with Jesus, keep that. What doesn't work for you, let it go. Watch what else God might do in those areas of your life that are important for you. And so bundling and unbundling, we may come back and talk about this more because I just think I've never heard the terms before. Mm-hmm. And I was reading it going, I love this so much. This would give people a very different way to approach change in their life instead of all bad or it's all good. No, some things are good, some things are bad. Eat the chicken, toss the bones about everything in your life.
Yeah, and I think that aligns with some of the other things that you and I have both had on our hearts that we've already talked in some regards, we've talked about in the podcast in regards to like untangling, or you've used the illustration of untangling the Christmas lights with different groups as you're, you know, creating that picture of like the knot of the Christmas lights and untangling that. And I think that's that imagery of there was still, it wasn't that God wasn't still a part and still active in your life during those other seasons and those other times. And so it's like, okay, don't throw everything out. Don't take a stick of dynamite and just blow the whole thing up and start completely over. There are things to be found that, like you said, that don't throw them out. There are things that are there that actually were true, that actually had things for your heart that you needed. Now, there might have been some other things that latched onto that or skewed it or twisted it or whatever that might look like. But there is – don't completely disregard the journey that you've already been on.
And even do that with friendships. Who says you have to go to that church to be friends with those people? Now, maybe that's how they want to see it.
Yeah.
But unbundle your friendships. There's some ones there that were destructive and walk away. Yeah. There's some other ones there that were encouraging, nurturing, really enjoyed spending time with them. Invite them over. Seek them out. See if they're willing to unbundle. Some of them aren't. Some of them are going, oh, you got to be here to have a relationship with me. Oh, that's fine. But it goes to everything. Just, I think it gives us an eye toward what is fruitful in my life toward that life in Christ I want to live, that he's called me to. Embrace those things. What's unhelpful to that, let go and see what God provides in their absence.
Love it.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.